listening to the Everything You Want to Know About Therapy But We're Too Afraid to Ask podcast with your host, Jessica Strang, and your co-host, Jennifer Trevelli. If you've ever wanted to start therapy but didn't know where to begin, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, we will offer, what you call Therapy 101 by interviewing experts in the field and asking them anything and everything you want to know about therapy before you make that first appointment.
Steph Myers is a licensed clinical professional counselor who has been practicing for 15 years. Her primary clinical focus is working with individuals experiencing difficulty with life transitions. She has specialized training in working with mood disorders, crisis intervention, and adolescent and adult ADHD. Currently, Steph has a private practice in Evanston, Illinois.
Steph Myers, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you guys today.
Welcome. I'm so excited. So just for our listeners to know, I actually yet have another guest here that I've known for a while now. Steph, do you want to tell everyone how we know? Well, you and I know each other. You and Jennifer had just met virtually today, but you and I have known each other for a while.
We were suite mates for a long time. We shared a suite in our offices here in Evanston. And we were in independent practices, but shared a waiting room. And so we've had this wonderful shared experience of being, independent practitioners, but having a colleague right next door. It's like a coworker, but you don't really work with them, but you work adjacent to them.
And it was nice. It was totally nice. Jen, I used to go for consultation, like right now, I'm literally knock on the door. I'm like, are you free? Or we'd talk about the food that we're eating. Like she made good recommendations. Mm-hmm. It was actually delightful. So I'm sad that we're not together.
Which bathrooms are free and how we do it quickly, right? Okay. important stuff.
Give you the Those are very important things. Very important things.
It's always good to know where the good bathrooms are, no matter where you are.
Yep.
Where you are.
But we're not so far now. Now I'm just sort of across the street. And when, normal life resumes, hopefully we're able to, share some space again.
Oh, I hope so. So let's get started. Jen, take it away.
Sure. So we typically, Steph, start off by asking how you got into this field. Where did it all start for you?
Sure. So this is a second career for me. I was initially out of undergraduate. So I went to college and I studied English, which makes you qualified for reading books professionally.
Steph, let's humble brag for a second. You started college a lot earlier than most people started college. So can we humble brag about that?
It sounds like a humble brag, but it was a series of weird coincidences. So I graduated high school early because I started school at a young age. I started school as a 4-year-old, and then I went to a school like a normal school where you're off, you're off in the summers and you go all year round. And then we moved into a community that had this huge population boom and we went to year round school. But when I transferred from the first school system to the second school system, I ended up skipping a grade. So at that point I was really, really way ahead. So I ended up graduating from high school when I was 16.
And so can I started imagine, college. Jen? Isn't that crazy?
No.
So I started college quite early and was probably too young, but I was an English major and I loved to read and I love stories. And I think in some ways that began the thinking about psychology because it's the study of people's stories, their life stories. And when I graduated initially, I was a technical writer and I worked for a bunch of software companies. I did technical writing and then I did training and design and things of that sort. And I did that for about 10 years. I became a management consultant and I traveled all over and it was super fun. And then I realized that there was a shift that needed to happen. And I started exploring what things interested me and did all the online quizzes like you do and helping professions just kept coming up. And I was really into The Sopranos and I thought Dr. Amalfi's job looked so cool and her office was so nice. And I thought I could totally do that. So I applied to graduate school and I'm not exaggerating. That's about how deep I got into the thinking about it. So,
is that how you got in? Like, did you write that as your essay, your entry essay? Like, I really love
this. No, photo. Of course I talked about wanting to help people and really feeling like I brought things to the table and all the wonderful things one does. Right. But so I started school, actually, I started a program at University of Chicago and it was in human development and it's a very research focused program. And I realized pretty quickly that clinical work was going to be my focus. And so I spent some time there. And then the woman who was running our program, Nancy Stein, who is amazing, wrote a letter of recommendation for me and helped me find a clinical program that was going to meet my needs. So then I went to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, which was clinically focused. And that's kind of how I got here.
And what was that experience like? Sorry to interrupt. What was that experience like to go to Chicago School and also having had then, you know, real life work experience outside of psychology? Like how how was that? Yeah. How did it all kind of fit in?
You know, there was lots of features when I think about that time. Like I think about the age of the people in my cohort. They were mostly straight out of undergrad, and I had been out of undergraduate school at that point, probably 12 years or so. Like I was a full grown, you know,
adult.
Mortgage grown. Married adult. Yeah. By the time I finished my graduate program, I was about 17 months pregnant. Like I was, you know, really, really moving along in my adult path and stuff. So it was a really good program and I was really glad for it. You know, the program helped me really solidify what my area of focus, you know, needed to be. Mm-hmm. But the program was clinical psychology and then it was an assessment track. So I did lots of assessment tool study and it was good. It was good. I think that I was probably on the older end of age range of the people who were in my program. And we were a cohort who all moved through. I don't know if your guys' program was like this, because I think you guys both went to Adler, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So our cohort went from class to class to class together. There wasn't a lot of like switching up like in undergrad. Like we were all one big body of people moving through at the
same time. No. Yeah. Do you remember that, Jen?
No. I mean, I feel like there was probably a group of us that ended up in the same classes. And then there was Jessica and I who made sure that we took all the same classes.
Absolutely.
So that we had each other.
Absolutely. That was totally by not coincidence at all. And people did recognize that eventually.
Right. We made our own cohort happen.
You guys were a two for one.
We were.
You don't even know the half of that stuff. Like, and then we made it happen in practicums too, which is like literally the impossibility, you know, of impossibilities. But yes,
When you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything.
Right. Yes.
But I think our experience was the opposite of yours. Is when we started graduate school, our average age of our class was significantly older than us. And I remember that was something that we kind of initially were like, ooh, like, are we too young for this? Because I remember in my interview for school, I think they told me the average age was like 40.
Correct.
Of the students.
Mm. Yeah. And that was like,
that wasn't the case in ours for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So do you think that helped you like relating to people or just like kind of like just maybe more aha moments like, oh, that makes sense because I've lived this life or something.
You know, I feel like I probably had a perspective, just a different perspective. I had, you know, I wasn't coming just from a theoretical perspective. Like I had real life experiences, right? Just like a little bit more maturation than I think some of my peers. And so I was there to finish a program and go deep into the program and be through the program. I didn't do a ton of socializing with my peers. And plus they did it at like 10:30 at night. Like, let's meet up for a study at 10:30. I'm like, I'm so not going to do that. It's downtown. I live in Lincoln Square at the time. Like that's a train. That's not going to happen. So I think it was, and I have a friend right now who's my age now, and she's doing a program at Northeastern, and she's definitely on the higher end of ages of the program, and she's sort of similar. She's like, I'm here to do the program, do a deep dive in what I'm here to get. I'm recognizing what I need and what I don't need, and taking from the program what I really, really need, and like letting some of the fluff go, right? Not all programs have fluff, but some do.
Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Assignments and professors that, you know, just want to give you like busy work. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the program was challenging and I worked really hard. But you're also when you're an adult graduate student, it's just, you know, you're more organized with your time. You know what it takes to do well in a class. You know, you have to do the readings. You know, you're not as distracted by things like happy hour, right?
Mm-hmm. Totally. Right, bachelorette parties.
Be.
Yes.
Right,
I totally.
So we don't know anything about that.
I think was a distraction sometimes. I mean, like, you know, Adler does not want to hear me say that. But so when you were in graduate school, did you do practicums or internships or anything like unpaid work, basically?
Yeah, I did. So in grad school, my practicum was at Rush Rush Behavioral Health and their substance abuse treatment program.
That's a good one.
It was a really good one. And I'll be honest, I was kind of, you know, we now know because we've all been doing this for a little while that it's really hard to find a practicum site right now, right? Mm-hmm, because there's way more graduates than there are practicums and you have to really advocate for yourself. That wasn't the case necessarily when I graduated. And I didn't get my first choice. And it turned out to be this was the best choice in the big scheme of things because I wasn't particularly interested in substance abuse, but I did not know how pervasive it was going to be across my work as I, you know, kind of developed as, you know, a professional. So it was a really, really good experience. But I definitely went into it with a wah, wah feeling. Because I had other ideas of what I thought I wanted to work, you know, what kind of work I wanted to do. But it was probably the best thing for me for sure. So that was the unpaid work that I did. And then right after I was done with that, I did group work for a while. I worked in a series of long-term care facilities where I facilitated group therapy. And it was different kinds of topics. It was people in cognitive decline. There were people who were in long-term mental health facilities. And that was super fun. It was a little bit like running your own talk show. A lot of energy, right? Like a lot of energy to the sessions. But I would go to like, you know, on a given day, I would go to like four or five facilities and I would have a series of topics that I ran through and, you know, gather up all the residents and bring them into a room and, you know, do my thing. And I learned a lot. Like I, you know, went deep into all the things that I knew about how to run a group and realized that that was really good for that time and place. But really what I wanted to do was crisis work. I got a job working in a hospital system, which I did for a long time doing crisis intervention. Which was also really good because you are exposed to lots of different diagnoses that you only read about in grad school, but you don't see in real life. So that was a really good additional training ground, though that was paid.
That's interesting. And was that, because Jen, I know a little bit about Steph's CV just because in conversations, but was that the ER years?
Yeah. So I worked at two ERs in Chicago, one in Evanston and one in Chicago. And both were level one trauma centers. So that was a really high, like high volume emergency rooms. One is the closest ER to O'Hare. So that's a lot of, you know, traffic that comes from the airport and all sorts of, you know, fun things in that way. And then the other is on the border between Evanston and Chicago. So they were great, great experiences. I had lots of exposure to lots of different populations that I wouldn't have otherwise, you know, had exposure to necessarily, and diagnoses that you read about, but you wouldn't necessarily see in, you know, an outpatient practice otherwise. So they were really good experiences. I think crisis intervention is a really good early career move for folks coming out of graduate school.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I remember her telling me some story. Didn't you tell me about Ebola? Like that was kind of like,
oh my gosh. Yes.
Didn't you have like some kind of like, not, I mean, you didn't have it, you know, but like, you
No,
had,
I did not have Ebola.
You knew.
Yeah, when Ebola was the big scare. I was working at Resurrection Medical Center out near O'Hare and there was a flight that was coming in from Africa and they thought that the person on the flight was positive, had positive symptoms for Ebola. And I remember sitting in the crisis office and thinking, I work in behavioral health. I just do not feel like I'm equipped to manage an infectious disease at the level of Ebola. I'm out. Steph has to go now. Like I cannot help Ebola. I can help all the social issues that might come in, but I cannot. I'm not exactly sure how negative airflow technology works in those rooms where they bring those folks into, but I don't feel like I have a part there.
Yes. And little did you know where we'd be, you know, like years later.
Right. I know so much more about infectious disease now than I ever would have known had I not worked there. Right. It's been helpful in this pandemic.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So it's good. Those are good experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could not imagine having worked in like a behavioral health hospital where I worked in crisis all the time. Could not imagine the level of crisis that an ER would bring. Because we kind of would get them after they've like peaked at that crisis. Like they're still in crisis, but now we're there to kind of stabilize and move on to the next point where you guys are getting them right at that main crisis.
Do you know, I think that, I think this is where being maybe like just a little bit older kind of came into play. Like I didn't, And when I had interns frequently when I worked in the emergency room, you know, and like there were key personality traits that made you successful at being in this job. And there were ones that made you difficult, you know, made it difficult for mm-hmm. you. Like if you believed that you needed to know how you would manage every single case that might appear, like if you needed to know all the things, it was going to be hard because you can never know what's about to happen, mm. right? In an emergency room.
Yep.
But if you believe that you can navigate with the support of your team members, whatever comes in, then you can figure it out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But you're never going to know all the things because it's just too crazy. It's just too crazy. Right. It's also long periods where nothing happens and then periods of time where it's nonstop, but it's really about your capacity to feel like you can navigate what's coming at you.
I love hearing you say that because I think that mm-hmm. sometimes like, you know, in the opposite end of it as being, you know, going to graduate school and being so green and having zero life experience and then feeling like everybody knows so much more than me. I better, you know, like try to catch up and realizing very quickly there is no one book to read. There is no one theoretical right. orientation. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's trusting that you don't know, but you can find out or you have people right. that can help.
You know how okay to find to know. Out. Yeah.
There's too many things to know all the things, right? So
yeah.
the only thing you can do is trust that you will figure out what's the right thing, right? Where you come back to your own personal ethics and values and, you know, the training that you've received up to this point is going to be solid. And you use that to figure out how you navigate the stuff that you're unfamiliar with, right?
And so after working there, what made you switch over to where you're currently working from ER? Was yeah. it just burnout? Yeah. Was it like just to see what could happen? What made you
switch? No, I think going back to my Sopranos, I always wanted to be in private practice. But I knew that I wanted to be able to go it solo. I knew I didn't want to be in a group practice. I knew I didn't want to work, you know, at an agency. So I did do a little bit of agency work at in between my periods of time where I was in the ER. I ran an outpatient clinic here in Evanston too, associated with the hospital. And I realized that I wanted to be solo. I had been an entrepreneur in my previous life. I had been, you know, when I was a management consultant, there was periods of time where I was self-employed and I loved that aspect of just kind of running my own ship. But I knew that I wanted to have some broader training. So I had to have these other experiences before I could go into private practice. And so when I was at the last hospital, I was setting up my private practice and really sort of starting to kind of dip a toe. And that's when Jessica, when you and I met, mm-hmm. I rented the office next to you and slowly, you know, sort of dipped a toe and built up my practice. And I remember those early days having conversations with you about how do I find clients? And you're like, register with these insurance panels. They will come. And you were right. They did come.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those early years of setting up a practice are always so scary. But it mm-hmm. sounds like, you know, you had a good business mind, you know, and also the background, like the chops to actually do it and say, yeah, I could take that on or whatnot.
I believed I could figure it out. And I felt like I knew just enough clinician, like just the right amount of clinicians that I could seek consultation when I needed to. I wasn't worried about the non-psychology side of things, like setting up the business side of the house. Because, you know, when people think about setting up private practice, that's what people say. Like people who are in private practice are really good at the work, but they really are bad at setting up the business piece. Like I knew I could do that part. Mm-hmm. I was a little bit more nervous about, you know, setting up a private practice and being a good clinician. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I think that that was just lack of, you know, experience of doing one-on-one therapy. I had done it in group settings. I had done it in ER settings and I had done it, you know, in outpatient settings that were, you know, a high volume, but I hadn't done it one-on-one in sort of a business, you know, where you're building a business around the types of clients that you want to see and you want to provide the type of services you want to provide. That was sort of a, you know, a big holistic nut that I needed to produce and create. And I feel like now I've settled into it. I've been doing it for about 15 years, I think, maybe.
Oh my goodness.
Maybe just shy of 15.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I've found a groove. Like I know what clients I work with well. I know, you know, what clients I don't work with well. And I think that fit is super, super important. I know, Jessica, mm-hmm. you and I have talked about this before, you know, mm-hmm. What is a good fit and what's not a good fit. And then how do you navigate that piece? So that was part of, you know, how you kind of get to where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, kind of along that line, what do you think makes a therapist good?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. You know, I think, I know when I was thinking about studying clinical psychology, I called an old therapist I had in St. Louis, which was where I'm from, and said, you know, I'm thinking about doing this, and what do you think? And what I wanted her to say was, yes, you're smart enough and you're not crazy, right? And what she said was, you just have to know your own stuff. Like, know what's yours, own it, work on it, figure out what that is, because that's really, really important. And that has been so, so true. So I think therapists who are good therapists, they know what their stuff is, right? And they do all the other stuff too. They keep boundaries. They recognize where they have, you know, bias. They recognize that finding the right fit for themselves and their clients is really key, because if that connection's not there, it's not going to work. Nobody wants to come to therapy when it's a slog. You know, we are, part of our job is figuring out how to build those connections. And so I think, you know, if you're good at making those connections with people and you can do it in a boundary-filled relationship, you're actually modeling the kind of relationships that people are coming to us to figure out how to have, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's so key. The two things that you just said right now, one about, you know, knowing your stuff, because I remember a long, long time ago having a wonderful mentor that I had just interviewed in the last episode. And I had seen a case, you know, I was in Dreiker's. Remember Dreiker's, Jen? It was a practicum. And so I was seeing a case and I missed it. I missed the meat and potatoes of it. And I was glad, because later on, and in the beginning, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm just like the worst therapist ever. And that wonderful mentor said, we all have blind spots and this was yours. And now you have to keep an eye on it. And now you have to know if there's more. Mm-hmm. And now you have to kind of like work around it. So then it was no longer a blind spot. Now I knew, I'm like, okay, I understand that there's this part of me that can be very sensitive about X, Y, and Z and about this type of client. So now I have to really be aware, is that what's that about? And where am I seeing that? And where, and really kind of separate. And then the other piece to it, you know, is just having those good boundaries and wanting to do good work and wanting to produce good connections. And I think that's so important stuff.
And I think being curious, you know,
yes,
being curious about why you're feeling what you're feeling, why clients might be feeling or reacting the way that they are, right? Really keeping in check anything that feels more like, oh my gosh, there was this Ted Lasso episode recently. It was talking about like being curious versus being judgmental. You know, there's this little snippet in one of the episodes and I thought, oh my gosh, that's so perfect.
Was it his therapist that said this?
It was not his therapist.
But I don't remember who said it.
He was playing darts.
Right? Yes. I remember this.
You know, he smashed the ex-husband with the epic, you know, darts, acumen, right? And it was like, you know, people who are curious ask questions, right? And that's what our job is to remain curious, right? Not to preform a judgment or assessment and like make people fit into it. And then also being curious about why we feel the way we feel about particular experiences or how things evoke feelings in us. Like, what's that about? And I think that's a really big key about being a good therapist, is just to be really open and being mindful. And boundaries.
So we'll get to that in a second. You know? Like, I guess I have a question, you know, it's just like, when it comes to knowing that, how do you personally check yourself? Like, for example, do you do consultation groups? Do you talk to other people? I personally talk to the both of you separately, you know, a lot of times, like, you know, so like, what do you do, you know, in order to kind of maintain that curiosity, the questions, that looking at the blind spots, all that stuff?
Sure. So, you know, for me, I think whenever something evokes, whether it's in the therapy or in, you know, my outside life, when something evokes a really big feeling in me, my initial reaction is like, what's that about? That's a really big feeling, right? Mm-hmm. That's a really big thought. It's a really big reaction. Why do I keep mulling over that, right? And I have to kind of maintain curiosity about that. And I do seek consultation, right? I talk with you, Jessica. I have a dear friend, Carrie Sandy, who I also have consultation with. I had a consultation group here in Evanston pre-pandemic. It's sort of fallen away a little bit.
That's too bad. I remember you liked that group a lot.
I did like it. It was really, really beneficial. And maybe when things get back to normal, two of the folks in that group retired. But it was a really good seasoned group of people in different various stages of their career. But hopefully, you know, that can start back up. I think consultation is really important, You know, because sometimes we get in our own head about stuff and we need an outside professional perspective, right?
I totally agree with you. I totally agree. When it comes to making that connection with a client, how do you know when you're done? You know, because maybe you've worked on a problem, you resolved it. Instead of that, like, let me take it back a second. When someone comes to see you, Steph, what is the process for them? Because I guess it's another piece, like, for that, I don't think Jen, you and I have discussed this a lot in the episodes, is, you know, what from soup to nuts, you know, like, what does somebody go through in calling you and then we'll get to the, you know, how things end afterwards. But how does that start for you?
So that's a really good question. And I don't know, I will say that I don't know how normal my process is. When somebody reaches out to me, I always have a consultation ahead of time. And I give a 15, 20 minute conversation, and I'm looking for fit. Like, you know, are the things that they're looking to work on in my sweet spot of things that I can help them with? And I'm also looking for, you know, what's their past experiences in therapy? You know, are they taking medications? Have they had, you know, a history of any sort of, you know, acute psychological or psychiatric, you know, concerns? Like, I want to have a full perspective on the person before we talk about how we move forward. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of high level, right? That's like 10,000 foot view. The first session is pretty orchestrated. Ahead of time, there's a bunch of paperwork that people fill out. And in my stack of paperwork, there's a list called a concern checklist. And in the first session, we really walk through the concern checklist, because those are the big items that are causing distress, right? And that gives me, in walking through that concern checklist, I start to get a view on how they are operating in their world right now. Right. So that kind of takes up the whole first session, is the concern checklist. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the first session, I talk a little bit about, you know, my therapeutic orientation is sort of psychodynamic and also really heavily cognitive behavioral. So as part of our next session, we will talk through thought distortions. So in between the first and second session, I send them a list of thought distortions and ask them to reflect and highlight the ones that they feel like come up for them. And in the second session, we talk about which ones come up for them. Right? There's always some frequent flyers like catastrophizing and black and white thinking and those sorts of things. And we build a vocabulary around the way that they're perceiving their world. And we talk about how thought distortions skew their perspective and make problems feel like they're really, really real when they're really feelings they're having about the problem. So that colors everything we do going forward. So we're kind of building the vocabulary. And in the third session, I'm a really, really big believer in self-care, and not just like soft self-care, like, oh, bubble baths are important. Like, they are important. But
yes, they are.
and part of like initial conversations with folks, I really check in about their self-care in a really pretty detailed way. And I have conversations around like, how are you navigating hardcore things that keep our lives in balance? Tell me about your nutrition. Are you putting things into your body that your body needs? And that doesn't just mean food. It also means caffeine, your relationship with alcohol, prescription drugs not prescribed to you, recreational drugs. I want to know all that kind of stuff. I want to know, how are you navigating, you know, physical exercise? You know, you don't have to be training for a marathon, but are you getting some kind of exercise? Because we know as clinicians how beneficial exercise is for managing stress, right? And managing your cortisol and your serotonin and all that stuff, right? How are you navigating your social relationships? Are you connecting with other people? Are you building and developing and deepening relationships that are important to you? How are you navigating your technology use, right? Are you someone who finds yourself super distracted by technology use? Do you use it as an escape, you know, an escape valve? Actually, I use a framework of a beach house. And in my beach house, there are five pillars. And each of these things we're talking about are one of those pillars.
Really? This is fascinating. Okay. Yeah.
And I made this up. This is not like well-researched or anything. And when all the pillars are in place, you know, you have a solid enough beach house that can withstand the storms that are coming, right? If you've got four in place, if you know, it's a little bit wonky. You got three in place, you've got a structural issue, right? You've got two in place where you're really in a problem. And then I don't remember. I said nutrition, sleep, exercise, socializing, technology, how you're spending your personal free time. Are you developing hobbies? Are you deepening your interests on things? Is there a spiritual aspect to your world that's important to you? Is the fifth one. I feel like I'm missing one. But so this is something that we walk through in a really structured way. And so then I check back on it regularly, because when the distress comes up, it's usually that there is some self-care that's fallen away, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't solve all the world's problems, but that's kind of low-hanging fruit, that when we're doing that, that's the non-sexy maintenance that makes us able to navigate a lot of the stuff that's coming our way.
Right. Right. No.
So that's basically the first three sessions.
I love that. I love how detailed that is, you know, because everyone has a different process, but I feel like I love, mm-hmm, how you've structured it so that it's like, again, you're building this foundation towards,
right,
what are we going to do? You know?
Well, mm-hmm, and I like it because I feel like I hear from a lot of people who will say, I don't know what to do when I get to therapy. Like, yeah, I've taken that step. I've made the call. I have my appointment. Like the first session, I think across the board is usually gathering that information. And then I've had people say, like, I don't know, like, am I supposed to keep talking? Are they going to ask me questions? Like they, mm-hmm, they develop this anxiety about what is it going to be like when I go there? And I think kind of your approach gives a little bit more structure for somebody who's not like, who's not ready to just sit there and I'm going to spill everything, like needs some direction. I think it's a great approach.
You know, and I think what it does, it also gives me the one thing I'm forgetting on my beach house is sleep.
Because
you,
oh my
cannot,
gosh,
have,
okay,
stable,
girl,
you cannot have stable,
no,
mental health.
No,
that's you have consistent quality sleep. And so, yes, many people are so loosey-goosey with their sleep. So that's a really big key on the self-care thing. You know, and it also, I mean, it does, it allows me to get sort of a deep dive on where are they in the here and now, mm-hmm, right? And so there's a lot of casual conversation that's happening there, but it also gives me things to write notes about to ask about later, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're not nervous about how the first couple of sessions are going, because I say, it's going to be pretty structured. And then at the end of those first three sessions, I say, you know, I'm never going to be a subject matter expert on you, but I'm really good. Like, one of my really good attributes is I'm really good at noticing patterns, but you have to bring the content, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So bring the content and I will help you put together the patterns and some opportunities for some perspective taking. And together we work on the goals that we've defined here today, right?
I love that.
That's kind of my jam.
I really do. I mean, like Jen said, I really do love that because it's structure. It means safety. I mean, that's really why, like, right, you know, if you think of something, mm-hmm, like a pandemic where nobody knows what we're doing, we're all running around with our heads cut off, like March 2020, I'm thinking, you know, why? Because nobody knew what was going on. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
the NBA,
right,
shut down, right, you know, what's going to happen next, you know? And, mm-hmm, so like having just structure, even in something that feels like it doesn't have to have it, but it does, mm-hmm, is, I think, is so great. And then as you move through these goals that you've set with your client, how do you know when they're done? Because that's another thing is, sure, that people, mm-hmm, ask me all the time is like, when will I know? And I'm always like, I feel like, you know, like Obi-Wan Kenobi. I'm like, you will know.
You will know. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, in some ways I think, you know, I'm in the business of breaking up with people. You know, yes, I'm not looking to foster dependence over time. You know, I want people to feel solid about their capacity to use the coping skills that we develop together to recognize where their own personal blind spots are. How are they using their thought distortions to skew? Like, and once they get really good at seeing, I'm definitely using black and white thinking here, you know, I'm totally future tripping, right? All those things. Mm-hmm. And then they get their all of their self-care stuff in a space that they know how to maintain it. Eventually we recognize we have reached the goals that we were here for, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes it looks like people coming in and be like, I don't really have anything. That's an indication.
Yeah.
Or sometimes when it's right, when it can be more difficult, people start wanting to cancel sessions or skip sessions. And then you have to address that. Well, but now there's some content here. Maybe it's time for us to decide whether or not we have stuff to still work on. And it's okay if we don't. You know, and when I terminate with people, we usually have a date by which we're going to terminate. And terminate is such a terrible word. I know we're talking about ending our therapeutic relationship, right?
No. And what other words would you say? Because I've said graduate, and it feels like I'm like an instructor. You know what I mean? So
right,
I don't know what
as
to
though
say.
You're bestowing on them. Yes. They've done the work, right? Yeah. So I like to think about it as sort of just moving on. Like we're not going to meet weekly anymore. And sometimes termination for me looks like, you know, we go from meeting weekly to meeting every other weekly to meeting monthly to meeting once in a blue moon when stressors occur. We have check-ins, and sometimes people just don't need to be here anymore, and that's okay too, right? The goal is for them to develop the skills that they need to navigate on their own. And I think about that as sort of the moving forward. It's not breaking up or really terminating so much as it is just moving forward and not needing that support anymore. And that's, I think that's what we're here for.
I absolutely agree with you. Absolutely. Yes.
And of course, termination sometimes looks like people ghosting you too, right?
But... yeah, it does. It does feel like a bad breakup when you were younger.
right. Sometimes they just go away and you're left to follow up in consultation about whether or not that was personal.
Exactly.
So one of the questions that we've been asked, and it's kind of similar to when somebody's been through therapy before, you know, the process ended, they terminated. Should people come back to therapy after leaving?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, I don't know if it's a right or wrong way to navigate that piece. I think, I like to leave the door open for clients, you know, and I'm sure this is a shared experience we all had over the course of the pandemic. Many, many clients who had moved on and graduated came back, right? Because there was a very significant life stressor.
Right.
I don't think it's a sign of anything negative. I think it's a sign of recognizing that there's more growth to be had. I also think that sometimes there are times in our life where, you know, a therapist is a fit. And as we navigate forward, there are seasons in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. That maybe the therapist who was once a fit isn't the fit for the next stressor we have. And that's okay too, right?
I like that.
So I don't think it's, the therapist that you have when you're 18 may not be the same person you need when you're 35 or when you're 50. And that's okay.
I completely agree. Yeah. I really do like that because I say this because sometimes I've seen people, like I used to see a lot of adolescents until I moved offices to that office that you and I had a suite at. Mm-hmm. And then I started now years later, I've been there so long, I've become an old lady. Now I'm seeing them as they're getting older, you know? And, mm-hmm. and it's interesting because it almost felt like it's a totally different person in some ways, you know? And yeah. then, on the other hand, Jen and I were just talking to a girlfriend that said that she switches therapists, not all the time, not like, you know, like your underwear or something like that, but, you know, but switches it because like, I'm done with that therapist because we've resolved that problem together. And now I'm moving into remember that, Jen? It was just I was like, I didn't know this. Like, it was so good to get that insight from someone that uses therapy, you know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it was like like you had said, I'm in a different season. It's a different stressor. It's time for me to find a different fit with my therapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's okay. You know, I think it's important that we don't take that kind of thing personally. People move away and they want a different therapist. I often say to clients in the very early stages of establishing a relationship, why don't we meet a couple of times and then I'll check in and ask you, what do you think about this? Is this good for you? And by then, you know, I have a sense too for whether or not it's a fit. And if it's not a fit, I probably know more therapists than they do. And I'll probably have a sense for who might be a fit. So it's also not just the season. I think initially you have a sense for whether or not this is somebody who you feel like you can build a connection with, right? I think ebbing in and out of the flow of therapy, I think it's just a tool that we use, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. No, I completely agree. And I guess it to me, it sounds like it really is a goodness of fit. It's about finding somebody that you feel competent and that you can feel you're heard and understood. And that's the basics. So then I got to ask the opposite stuff is, what makes, and we've got a lot of stories on this, what makes a therapist a bad one? And I want to preface it by saying, just like there's bad mechanics, just like there's bad doctors. I listen to Dr. Death podcast, you know, so I know all about bad doctors, you know, like all these things. What makes a therapist bad in your eyes?
Oh my gosh. We could do a whole episode on bad therapist stories.
We do lot of stories. I will say this may be a longer show today.
You know, I like to ask people in our initial session, like, you know, tell me about previous therapy experiences.
Yes.
And Jessica, you and I have talked about this. Right?
Yeah, I feel like there have been loaded questions.
So many stories you've heard that don't even feel like they could possibly be real, you know, and you know, it kind of all comes down to boundaries.
So, can you share maybe some of your golden hits here of like maybe without getting into details, obviously, but like, you know, just the gist of like a theme what would make a bad therapist? Because I think here's the thing is when I ask that question, you're absolutely right. I always ask, what was your previous therapy like? What was the good and the bad? I always ask, you know, because there's always something to be said. I'm constantly surprised. And there's sometimes, I mean, I've had to, you know, give information to clients about that sounds like an ethical violation. You know what I mean? Like, and I have the number for like our professional regulation, you know, or the email, you know, in my back pocket, because I've had to say this so often. And I don't say, you know, it's everyone's choice what they want to do, but know that there, we have a licensing board and we have to adhere to a code of ethics, you know, and because right. It's that bad. So can you, you know, just highlight,
oh my gosh.
I know Jen and I so have a couple stories too.
There's like your stories of therapists nodding off in sessions, like falling asleep, right? Really yeah. bad business practices, not managing insurance well, you know, or charging, undercharging, overcharging. There's just hot messes of, you know, business practices. Bad boundaries. I've heard stories of therapists having social relationships. Like we've all heard stories of, you know, crossing personal boundaries, you know, of very violating natures. You know, I've heard stories of people hanging out with their therapists, going on trips with them, borrowing money to and from, like all sorts of really just bad, you know, bad boundaries. And those boundaries are there for a reason, right? Because it's incumbent upon us to create a relationship that is safe, that is boundary filled for people to be vulnerable and to work out the issues and concerns that are causing them emotional distress. And when those boundaries become permeable, you can do real damage. So
Absolutely.
At the core of every conversation around bad therapists, in my mind, it always comes back to boundaries, like people not managing good boundaries.
And I agree with you. And I feel like I've heard everything that you've said, you know, like, and by other people. And I think the other piece is that I didn't know this was not normal was the next thing that they follow up with. And, or, you know, like, I didn't know I didn't have to make food for my therapist. And I'm like, why would you want, I remember someone offering me and I'm like, no, that's fine. I've eaten and you don't have to do that. That's not part of this process, you know? And they're like, oh, well, my last person ... And I'm like, what is going on here?
Yes. An expectation of privacy. I've heard stories about people having meeting their therapists in public settings. I'm not talking about like pandemic meeting in a park or, you know, therapy walks, which is something I've done with clients before, but like, you know, meeting in the library in not a private space, you know, where people are just, it's just no. And also I think what also makes a bad therapist is when people conflate therapy with advice giving.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is a pet peeve for lots of therapists. We are not in the business of giving advice.
Right.
We're not. There are, you know, you can ask Ms. Manners or you can ask Dear Abby. Like, we don't have advice to give. It's not like we're subject matter experts on how to live a good life, right?
There are specific things that
we're here to work on. So I think those are, boundaries and advice giving. Those are what make bad therapists.
I know one of our girlfriends that we met with, and she has approved us saying this story. But Jen, you take it away because I know, like, she was.
She was talking about kind of having an experience with a therapist and talking about her experience, talking about how she's feeling. You know, kind of going through the process with the therapist, and at the end, the therapist goes, "Well, I really just don't know what else to tell you. I don't know what to do." And she was like, "I didn't know what to say." She goes, "I didn't know what to do after that."
Well, and I literally laughed out loud when she said that, and I wasn't laughing at her. I was like, "What the hell kind of answer is that?" Like, what could she have said? I know this person, a very rational, compassionate,
she was talking about her anxiety. I mean, she was talking about her anxiety, and the therapist was just like, "Well, I got nothing for you. I don't know what to tell you."
what a terrible feeling for a client, right? I'm coming to you, I'm laying myself bare here, being vulnerable, and you're like, "I got nothing."
Right. Well, like, there is no
hope. Have something. Use like, your skills. Right.
Right. I mean, it's not like you're asking them to solve a math problem. And they're like, you lost me.
I'm out.
Right. I'm telling you. But I'm here, so here's another thing. So we get DM'd questions and things like that from our Instagram account. And there, that same thing happened too to someone else that had messaged and said that basically they're like, "Well, I really can't help you resolve this." And I don't think the person was looking for help with like a relationship situation is what they had written about. It was more of like, you know, kind of just guide me, or maybe like, you know, what are your thoughts about this? Anything
space
at all.
To constructively process. Yeah.
Yes, anything. It's like throwing, you know, just anything at all and nothing. And also, someone else had written about, you know, feeling like their therapist was blaming them for everything. And so I'm like, wow, okay, well, I mean, and I can't imagine, you know, how much victim shaming that person could have gone through as well outside of there. And so I say all this because it's like, we laugh about it, but these are stories that were told, right, by our clients. Right.
Real life experiences.
Right. Yeah. Real life. And yeah. So when you talk about boundary stuff, like, for example, okay, so I'm going to throw a couple of ones sure. that people have asked me, okay? Where do you live? I'm pretty sure we have the same answer. How would you answer that if somebody asked you, where do you live? Like what street? Like, what number, you know?
Sure. So I oftentimes will say to people, you know, I live here and I work here in Evanston. And now that we've met, odds are good that we're going to see each other. Mm-hmm. Right. So here's how that is going to play out. You know, I'm not going to say to you over the apples at Whole Foods, like, hey, how's that situation with your mom? Right. Because that's bad boundaries, right?
Right.
I'll say hello. If you say hello back, that's fine. If you choose not to greet me, I won't take it personally. And if someone were to ask me, you know, where do you live or tell me about your family, I would ask, that's interesting. Tell me about why that's important to you. Why is that? Why are you curious about that? You know, ask some more follow-on questions. I wouldn't give out my personal address because that's a boundary. Right. Okay. I'm a person that we are, you know, my job here is to help you process stuff. It's completely normal to be curious about your therapist's personal life. Right. And I'm sure that people Google and try to figure out all sorts of things about their therapist. There was a song about it.
Was there?
There was a song about it a few years ago. Yes.
Now I'm curious about that.
Kristen Bell did a song about how much she loved her therapist.
You know what? You sent that to me. Yes. You, remember, you sent that to me.
People are curious about it. And I get it, right? But it's also our job to model what having a privacy boundary looks like, right?
I think that's so
people
important.
People ask all sorts of personal questions, right? Oh, people do. And they're, because they don't understand. They're looking for you to model it. And if you, you know, it's difficult to do that initially, to say, it's interesting. I can tell me why you're curious about that. And just also say, I'm afraid that's not something I'm willing to share.
Absolutely. I think that the more experience that you have sometimes as a clinician, you just have a better set of ways to say that to people and where you feel comfortable. But like you had said, going back to the type of relationship you're trying to achieve with your client, is it's a model, but it's not exactly the same, you know? So it's not going to be, I'm not your mom, I'm not your brother, I'm not your sister, you know? So that's stuff that you would share, but you would use some of these tools outside of there, the boundary stuff too. Right. And so like, I think that's really important to highlight is that it is just the model. It's not the everything. You know what I mean?
You know, I had a client for a long time, and this isn't really too revealing, who liked to bring me coffee. Like he would come into session, he brought himself a coffee and he would always bring me a coffee, and I always paid for the coffee. And it was, you know, it made him uncomfortable that I paid for the coffee, but it was an important boundary that we weren't having a transactional relationship in that way. Right. And we had to spend, you know, probably 20 minutes talking about why I had to do that.
Every time
I was rejecting his no.
Oh, okay. So I was gonna say just wow,
one time, that's, just one time.
A lot of coffee,
right? But that's also a boundary, right? To say it's a lovely, thoughtful gesture, and I'm not going to have you financially providing me things of that nature because that's not the nature of our relationship. We're not friends or colleagues. This is a therapeutic relationship, right? And we're here to work on some stuff.
Absolutely. And so I guess my question too, like the follow up was, what would you say to someone who's had a negative experience? Like I told you my little, you know, my spiel about like, well, here's like the professional regulations, you know, if you want to, or whatever, what would you say if someone said to you this horrific story of like total boundary crossing and inappropriate behavior by a former therapist?
You know, I'm pretty no holds barred about it. When I say it's inappropriate, it's unethical, and that must have been really hard for you. And we provide space to sort of process their experiences and talk about why that's wrong and how that won't be how we will navigate. And that, you know, you can provide feedback about things that make you uncomfortable in this space and we can talk about it. And then also, you know, provide them some space to also say, do you want to follow through with a report and let me help you navigate that piece? Because, you know, our profession is important that it's regulated in a way that keeps us ethically bound. People need to feel like they can have a set of expectations when they enter a therapeutic relationship. We've had lots of experiences with people, and I know Jessica, you and I have talked about it over the years. But just people have really, there are odd therapists out there. There are. You know, the profession draws an interesting crowd, right?
Yes. Yeah. people that haven't worked out, like you said before, people that haven't worked out their stuff, I think are maybe doing that in session with other people. And that's inappropriate.
For sure. And there's not a lot of oversight, right? So if you're in private practice and you are someone who is not aware of, you know, your biases and your issues and your concerns and your own personal psychology, you can operate without anybody knowing about it, right? Because you're not having collegiality, you're not having passive conversations with people, and you can, you know, you can do real damage with that sort of thing unchecked. So I think it's important, and it's incumbent upon us to continue to talk about why ethics and boundaries are important, you know, as we talk about, you know, working with younger clinicians and interns and that sort, just to keep sure that, you know, our profession is continuing to evolve in ways that make people feel safe.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that is not readily talked about. People don't readily share, like, oh, well, this is what my therapy experience was. This is what my therapy experience is. So people oftentimes go to therapy and don't know that that may not be how it should be. They don't know about those boundaries. And so, they have no frame of reference other than like sometimes what you might see in a TV show of what a therapist is, or like what you envision therapy is going to be like. And so you don't know that what that session was like is not appropriate or not how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So what should people expect when they go to therapy?
I mean, people should expect that, you know, that it will be a safe, comfortable place for them to work on the things that are defined between them, you know, themselves and the therapist. You know, they should expect confidentiality, you know, with the caveats of the areas that, you know, where confidentiality has to be broken.
Mm-hmm.
They should expect to have support, you know, and at its baseline, I think unconditional positive regard. Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Some space where their thoughts and feelings are allowed to be in a non-judgmental space that they can work through what they want to talk about. They can feel what they need to feel, you know, for that session on that day.
I like that. Steph, what do you feel like you like the most about your work that you do?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I have the best job on the planet.
Aww.
I really, really do. I love my work. I get to be with people in the process of growth every day. And that's amazing. You know, I get to hear people's stories and their successes and be able to be adjacent to them when they are struggling. You know, I had a couple weeks ago where I had a handful of clients who were just hashtag killing it. Like, they were having really positive life experiences. Like, things were really falling into place. And I thought, man, I have the greatest job on the planet. It's not always that way. Sometimes people they struggle, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in the pandemic, lots of people were really, really struggling. I am someone who is really fed by deep conversations with people. I'd like to have deep conversations that are meaningful. So I feel like this is the perfect fit for me. I'm a helper by nature. So it's, you know, I love my job. I think it's amazing. I would find it exhausting if I had high level conversations, 5,000 of them a day. Like, that would be just really the worst case scenario. But
Well, I can say, as somebody who, unlike Jessica, just met you today, it's clear that you love your job and kind of how you talk about it, how you talk about your clients, how you talk about the whole process. It's definitely clear that you love your job and are good at it as well.
That's nice. Thank you.
She actually is really as wonderful as you think she is. You know what I mean? I can vouch for that, you know, and I think that, and it to me, honestly, Steph, in just hearing, you know, I mean, I obviously know you, but in hearing other parts that I haven't known about you, like going back to originally just being a lover of books and lover of stories, that really is what people are doing, is they come into your office and they storytell for those 45, 50 minutes, whatever it is. And you have to kind of look for the themes, and you have to look for, you know, what makes sense and what, like you said, the patterns, right? And so I think it's such a fitting description of what what you do, is that you originally just love storytelling and hearing that. And that's what you do. And you hear that of 8 hours a day, or 8 different stories a day. You know what I mean? Or how many people you're seeing that day. Yeah.
You pick up so many books each day.
It isn't that interesting, you know? And I think that's one of the things, I guess what I have a pet peeve is when people say to me, like, oh, I don't know how you do that job. And I'm thinking, like, why? I would never say to somebody else, like, I don't know how you do that job. That's rude, right? A.
Right, right, right.
B, like, so there's something wrong with liking to be with humans and studying human behavior and listening to the good, the bad, the ugly, you know, I guess it's just, it's fascinating. Then why would you watch television? Because if it's literally the same thing, you'd be on the Weather Channel the whole time, right? I mean, even then it would change. Yeah. You know what I mean? That it would be a hurricane at once in a while. So it's just one of those things, you know.
People say that to me too. Like, I don't know how you do that job. And I say the same thing. I have the best job on the planet. Like, I have found, you know, that thing that is the perfect fit for, you know, my personality, my interests. And I think it's the best thing ever. And I think that people have a hard time envisioning what it's like to be in a space where people are authentically vulnerable and raw, right? But it's super meaningful. And it's also really amazing when people can make shift and change. So,
I think it says a lot about the person who says that. You know what I mean? Because I mean, at this point, most people I know have been in
therapy.
But
you can't say that because that makes people paranoid that you're also, you know, analyzing.
Right. If they only knew, I'm thinking about my laundry that I have to, I'm like, has it closed in the dryer? I don't know. You know. I mean, not in therapy, in my real life. That's what I'm really thinking about. Steph, I guess I have a question. Other than how do you do this job, what's the other most frequently asked question you get about anything in your field?
I think probably like recently has been, oh my gosh, is it so bad right now? Because, you know, through the pandemic, obviously there's been, you know, a real uptick in people with mental health struggles. And, you know, is it so bad? I guess good for business, but you know, we're not in the business where we want it to be good for business. We want people to be, you know, healthy and happy and navigating. So I think people tend to be a little bit cynical about, you know, what it means to be having a mental health struggle. You know, I think younger generations are really open to the idea of mental health, but I think other, you know, older generations maybe have a perspective like, oh, that's just a bellwether for how bad the universe is. And I think about it as no different than, you know, what's the current clip at the local physical therapist, right?
Right.
Are people having injuries? Right. Are they not having injuries? Are they working through them? You know, and how are we navigating? So I think that's, I guess that's my answer.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the questions that we've asked all of our guests on our show is, what is something that you wish people knew about your work or about the field of psychology?
Mm-hmm. That I don't have a crystal ball. I have no idea what's going to happen in the future. You know, I'm not an expert on how to be a human.
You really are doing a good job, I will say, because I know you personally. You know, I mean, you're hitting a lot of those milestones and
benchmarks. And people have a lot of ideas of what they think it's like. And, you know, I think it's interesting because I think there's, in the media, there's really good representation of what therapy looks like. You know, when I talk with students who are thinking about going to graduate school, I always recommend, like, you should, you know, listen to Esther Perel's podcast because you can hear couples therapy is about, right? Or In Treatment, right? The television show is a pretty good depiction of what therapy looks like and how messy sometimes we are as people who are therapists. We are real people with real problems.
Right. That
there's no expectation that there's a perfect way to be in therapy. You know, it is something that you can utilize as a tool, and that's what it is. No more, no less. It's not the thing that's going to save you. It's also not going to be harmful. It's just a tool that you can utilize to figure out, you know, how do you gain new skills to navigate what life throws at you?
I love that.
I do too.
I really do. I mean, I think it's wonderful. I think it's, and then would you also add, I don't know if you've ever seen this cartoon called Dr. Katz. It was about being a therapist. Yes. That's what I thought therapy was like. And I think he just sat there. I was really surprised when I had to speak.
You know, I often, when I talk with somebody the first time, I always say, I'm a really interactive therapist. So if you've, you know, had therapy experiences before, people were silent. That's like, that's not my jam. And if that's what you're looking for, analysis is what you're looking for. This is solutions focused.
Right. Absolutely. There, right? You know, to be honest, it's been a long time since someone's come to me and told me that they had their therapist that just sat down and wrote notes. And I'm like, boy, I'm not that person because I can't stop talking sometimes. So, I mean, not in therapy, but in them. You guys, and to kind of end this, we do have to stop talking, Steph, because we've taken up a lot of your time today. And No. Thank you so much for being here. And then if folks want to find you, would you be okay if we included your information on our Instagram
absolutely.
Account, which for everybody that's listening, it is an Instagram therapy_podcast_. And I will be putting all of Steph's information on there. Is there anything else that you'd want to tell folks before we let you go tonight?
Do you know, I just think this is such a great podcast you guys are doing, because it really helps to put out there for folks who have been hesitant, because people probably think about being in therapy or calling a therapist for a long time before mm-hmm. they make that call, because there's hesitation, right? And this podcast really lays out there what are the things people are afraid to ask. And I think it's really such a really good, smart tool. So I just, such good work, ladies. Good for you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. We just wanted another reason to work together.
Yes.
So we've been doing it since 2001. You know, so why break the streak? Well, Steph, thank you so much for your time, and have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been fun, ladies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to good podcasts. And keep up with episode updates on Instagram at therapy_podcast_. There, you can send us messages on topics you'd like to hear about or anything that comes to mind. Bye for now.